me pones un ejemplo. Entonces, si tú no quieres hablar conmigo, dímelo para yo no llamarte ni molestarte, porque nada más quedaba tú.
Real talk. Real people. Real stories. The He's Just Podcast. Yeah! Welcome, everyone, to another He's Just Podcast. I'm your host and founder of the He's Just a Social Worker Movement with another amazing show for you today. But before we get started, I want to remind everyone that this platform was built because way too often as people, we were overlooked or labeled or put in boxes. But this is no longer. Our plight and our fight is for anyone and everyone who feels a need to be understood. We are strong as individuals, but unstoppable when we unite. I want to take us back today. The Greensboro Massacre, which happened on November 3rd, 1979, in Greensboro, North Carolina. It was a tragic event in which five members of the Communist Workers' Party were killed by members of the Ku Klux Klan. Meet Aaron Shetterly, an author and journalist known for his work that bridges history, culture, and social justice. His first book, The Americano, Fighting with Castro for Cuba's Freedom, was well received, earning a critical acclaim from Publishers Weekly. From 2005 to 2009, Aaron founded and edited Inside Mexico, a widely read English language periodical. He has a strong academic background with degrees in English literature, Spanish language, and culture from Harvard. He also has a master's in American and New England studies. He has a diverse experience in media and publishing and has been involved with his father's organization, Americans Who Tell the Truth, since 2003. Today, we will discuss with Shetterly his new book, Morningside, The 1979 Massacre and the Struggle for an American City Soul. We walk with Aaron and learn in detail about him and this tragic point in history that is surely considered an overlooked chapter in our American history. Aaron, welcome to our show.
Great to be here with you, Jules.
Excited to have you. I know we chatted a bit before getting on set. Tell us a little bit about your journey and your walk. How did you get involved into this work?
You know, I grew up in a family. My mother's a writer, my father's a painter, and I avoided that kind of work as long as I could. And I went to New York and I worked in book publishing a little bit, and I worked with a friend who was doing an internet startup, and I did a variety of things. I tried to be an academic and realized I wasn't really cut out for it. And then in 2001, I took a trip to Cuba with my father to look at Cuban art, because I was really interested in Cuban art. I thought it was fascinating. And so we were touring around, and in the center of Cuba, in a little city called Santa Clara, we received a sort of a presentation on how Cuban democracy worked, which was an interesting presentation. And in the middle of that, I said, well, during the fight against Batista in the 50s, late 50s, before the revolution was won at the, you know, New Year's Day, 1959, I said, did any Americans or foreigners come to fight with the rebels here, with the Fidel Castro's revolutionary side? And the man looked around, and he said, not really, but there was this one guy, what was his name? And his secretary said, William Morgan, William Morgan. And I felt the hair stand up on the back of my neck. And I went home and I applied through the Freedom of Information Act to the CIA for documents. And I got this stack of documents, Jules, but every other line was blacked out, redacted. And I thought, I need to know what's under there. And I quit my job in New York and set out to write a book about this guy. And my mother said to me, Aaron, what are you doing? You've never written a book before. Go write some poetry, write an essay, write an article. I said, no, I'm writing a book. And I did. And I learned so much about myself and about this history and about how one goes about writing a sort of narrative nonfiction book. And I was hooked, very into writing and editing and thinking about how to tell stories at that point, true stories.
Amazing stuff. You know, the great ones always take that journey. They start out one way and end up another. Let's dive right in. Can you provide some background for us about the racial and political climate in Greensboro leading up to those events on November 3rd, 1979?
That's a great question. And what's interesting to me is, you know, when I set out to tell this story, Jules, I had no idea how deep I'd have to go into history in order to understand it myself, let alone communicate it out into the world, you know, through my writing. And so one of the things that Greensboro's known for is the beginning of the sit-in movements in 1960, when some four brave young men from North Carolina A&T University sat down at the Woolworths on Elm Street in Greensboro, North Carolina, and set off a wildfire. You know, that more students came to sit in the next day and more, and then it spread to other cities. And this really was what led to the end of active segregation in public spaces in the South. Mm. And so Greensboro is very proud of that history at this point, right? It took a while to get there for sure. And so, but in the mid to late 70s, when I'm writing about, that history was tolerated in some ways, but the establishment in Greensboro wasn't really sure whether they should be proud of this history or not at that point. They were still not fully comfortable with what that history had led to, right? And what that courage on the part of the people who lived on the southeast side of Greensboro had done to gain access to downtown. And it was still a very racially divided city. It still is in a lot of ways. And the people that I'm writing about in my book, and I'd like to tell you after this how I met them and how I came to this story, were dedicated to trying to organize in the textile mills in Greensboro and in the Piedmont of North Carolina. And these were still some of the biggest textile mills in the world. They hadn't been all shipped offshore yet. And we're talking about thousands and thousands of workers in these mills. And they were having trouble organizing across race. You know, you had your white workers and your black workers, and there really weren't any black workers in the minuscule unions that were in these textile mills. And so they thought, we've got to do something to show these workers and talk with these workers about how, unless they come together, they're not going to be able to make a strong demand to management. They're not going to be able to advocate for their rights, for their health care, for better hours, better pay, better working conditions, unless they can get together. But this was really hard, and the Ku Klux Klan was actually sort of suspicious of these unions and telling white workers not to join them, these multiracial unions. So they organized this march to educate workers in Greensboro. They were going to march and then have a conference and talk about this history of dividing white and black and poor people of different colors so that they couldn't come together. And as they were setting up, a caravan of Ku Klux Klansmen and neo-Nazis drove by and started shooting and killed five of these activists, a lot of the leaders, injured 10, and were never held criminally responsible for what they did. So that gives you a sense of what we're dealing with.
Amazing and tragic at the way. And even though this was so long ago, just hearing you as a wordsmith that you are, when you're listening in to some of this history, sometimes it takes us to a place of past failures, right? It kind of serves for us a reminder that we have to adapt to change But if we fight or try to shape, the setbacks are definitely coming in. So that's difficult. And thank you for sharing light on this. Let's talk more about the climate of Greensboro. Can you describe what the atmosphere was like during the rally, just before that violence kind of erupted?
Well, I think the way I'd like to talk about that is through the character, one of my main characters, Nelson Johnson. So Nelson Johnson grew up on a farm that his family actually owned, a fairly rare thing in rural North Carolina at that time, to have a Black family own their own farm and be self-sufficient in that way. In fact, they owned enough property that they had some tenant farmers on their farm, and they grew tobacco, and they grew wheat, and they grew corn, and they had livestock, and they didn't have cash, but they could eat. And they had a degree of independence. And his parents raised him in the spirit of this independence, right? That he was a very independent-minded person. And he wanted to see the world, went into the military. And in the military, he met up with some people who were beginning to lean toward Black power. And he started to see the United States in a different way. He sort of bought into the exceptionalism, the idea that America was exceptional, and that, you know, yeah, there were some things to fix, but you know, we were the good country. And he began to question this, and he came home and he went to the North Carolina A&T University in Greensboro, the Black state school, big flagship school for African Americans in North Carolina, very proud history. And in 1969, he's become a student activist and leader. And the high school in the Black section of town, it's called Dudley High School, refused to seat the student who had been elected to the president of the student council, because he was associated with Nelson Johnson. And the authorities, the white school superintendent and school board, believed that this was too radical, that they did not want Black power coming into the Black high school. And so they refused to seat him. The high school students began to protest, and they began to walk out of class, march in front of the school, and the police came in, and the police started to tear gas them, beat them, and things on the Black side of Greensboro, the southeast side, tensions escalated. Nelson actually tried to calm things down. He tried to bring the parties together. Let's work through this. Let's find a solution. Completely ignored. What this led to, Jules, was the largest military occupation of an American college campus in American history.
Mm.
The tensions rose. The National Guard surrounded North Carolina A&T University. Students on the GI Bill actually shot back at them from windows in the dorms, and then escaped through air ducts and into the night. And the next day, the military dropped tear gas from helicopters on the university and evacuated the whole university. 650 guardsmen going through, smashing doors, turning over mattresses, smashing people's TVs and radios. The person who ends up getting blamed for this is Nelson Johnson.
Mm.
The city points at him as saying he didn't stop it. He didn't do it. Whereas he had actually tried to work out a solution. The reason I tell you that story is by the time 1979 comes along, 10 years later, this is how the police and the white politicians in Greensboro thought about Nelson Johnson. They saw him as an enemy of Greensboro, as opposed to someone who was trying to make Greensboro better. And so, in a sense, 1979 comes out of 1969. And it happens in part because of this history that was already festering in the city and had never been resolved.
Wow, what a viewpoint. And just listening into you, there's like a sense of belonging that comes from Mr. Johnson's movement to just stand up and say, hey, I do want more of this that I require because I'm entitled. I have earned this. I also have a piece here. But there's something that you can say that when one stands up, some sort of problem can be identified. A situation will arise because once one person unites and you begin to identify with some sort of movement or struggle, thereafter, here comes the fight. Tell us more about what do you think the KKK and the American Nazi Party members and their role, and why were they acquitted during the state and federal trials? Why was this?
That's a great question. Before the November 3rd shooting, 4 months earlier, the KKK in a little town called China Grove in North Carolina announced that they were going to screen the racist film Birth of a Nation and try to recruit more Ku Klux Klan members. And the Nelson Johnson and the Communist Workers Party in Greensboro got wind of this. And they thought, let's go down and see what the Black community in China Grove thinks about this. And the Black community in China Grove was terrified that this was going to happen, offended that this was going to happen, but felt powerless to do anything about it because the Ku Klux Klan had requested permission to use the local community center and it had been granted. They had a permit to show this movie and to recruit there. So Nelson worked with the community. They decided to stage a march to try to interrupt the screening. And so about 100 people, about half from the community and about half who had driven to the community from Greensboro and Durham and Chapel Hill in North Carolina, drove down there and marched right up to the community center where, you know, several of these men were there with automatic weapons and rifles and they had, you know, gloves and hard hats on and were chanting, you know, death to the Klan, and the other guys were chanting white power. And there were two or three policemen there, Jules, and that was the only, that thin blue line was what kept something horrible from happening there. The police told the Klan to go back in the community center and stay inside. And they did. So Nelson and the others went away, but the Klansmen decided they were going to talk about getting revenge for being, you know, humiliated in this way. But that's only part of the story. People like to talk about that part of the story. It's all true. It did cause animosity. But what really then happened is the Greensboro Police Department was curious about what the Klan was going to do as the march on November 3rd approached. So they went to an old informant, a man who had been an informant to the FBI and a member of the Ku Klux Klan, and he had been an informant in the police before. And they said to him, they said, Eddie Dawson, will you find out what the Klan's going to do on November 3rd? So Eddie Dawson says, sure. He was kind of bored. He was like the intrigue. Got in his car, drove down to a big Klan meeting. But he didn't just listen. He got up and told these guys they had to come to Greensboro. It was their patriotic duty. He told them that they asked if they should bring guns. And he said, I'm not your father. I'm not going to tell you whether to bring guns or not. He said, but if you do, bring your bond money and don't wear them concealed. So in other words, he said, yeah, bring guns.
Wow.
So this was a police informant. And he went back and he told the police in Greensboro that as far as he thought, 80 Klansmen were going to come to Greensboro on November 3rd. He didn't tell them that he told them to, but he told them that they were coming.
Mm.
So, you know, the Klan was riled up when the, you know, when the people marched on their screening. But would they have really come? It's really hard to tell whether they'd been come if they hadn't been provoked by a police informant.
You know, looking at it from that standpoint and thinking about what they may or may not have been doing, there was like a sense of belonging, but there was a sense of disrespect during this time. When you think about what the KKK did in escalating this with this viewpoint, on top of them retreating back and going back into the community center, this was a second slap in the face. Like, these guys are there and you better be ready, because there's some sort of escalation that I felt as you were explaining, that the views of this rally were going to be an act of disrespect yet again, like a threat to their belonging and their ideology. And I think that that's why they reacted. And they had questions, and probably you're right. Is there an opportunity to even go back and say, had they not done that, had they not been provoked? Amazing stuff. From your lens, what are some of the long-term effects that you think that this event has had, not only on Greensboro, but on the fight against civil rights in the U.S.?
Well, I think there are different pieces of that. One of the things is there were some positive things that came out of this. So let me mention those first. So Greensboro, until this moment, had never had district voting. In other words, all the city councilors were elected by the whole city. There was no ward representation, no borough representation, right? If you're in New York, it was all, everyone in the city voted for the city councilors on a slate, and the top people got it.
Yeah.
So in a city that's 70% white and 30% black, getting a black person on the city council was tough. And the only black people who got on city council have been essentially vetted by, you know, the white people, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, after this shooting, because this was one of the central demands of the black community for decades, or a couple decades anyway, that changed. So ward voting came out of this, which was a positive step. Another thing happened that was positive, that's related to this, is in the criminal trials of the Klansmen and Nazis, when they were acquitted, the juries were all white, and the defense attorneys could use all their peremptory strikes with no explanation on anyone who was black.
Mm.
The rules changed shortly afterward, and this was part of the reason. The federal rules changed about how race could be used to strike a juror. So those are some things that came out of this would actually, you know, were positive.
Yeah.
But there were some negative things, and I think they pertain to what we're facing today. If you have some white supremacists who commit a crime and then are acquitted, they feel like they've been validated, right? They feel like they have impunity. They feel like they're representing white America in a way that is, well, to our way of thinking, pretty horrific, right?
Mm-hmm.
So these shooters in Greensboro became celebrities in the white nationalist and white power movement in the United States. So let me give you a pretty sort of chilling example of that. The head of the Nazi party at that time was a man named Harold Covington. Harold Covington was from North Carolina. He did not go to the where the shooting happened that day, but his Nazi followers did.
Mm.
Harold Covington was an idol of Dylann Roof, the young man who walked into the Mother Emanuel AME church in Charleston, North Carolina, sat down, prayed with the parishioners there, and then shot them as a white supremacist. Dylann Roof held up the Greensboro massacre as a shining example of white supremacy in action. So I have a really great friend I went to college with who's a lawyer and a legal scholar. And he reminded me when I was working, I said, Aaron, you know, it's not just good ideas that travel. It's bad ideas too. And this is one of those examples where you see that the legacy of an event like this, and when there isn't accountability for it, how it empowers a next generation and a next generation.
Truth be told, so much to hear and learn from this. I want to dive a little bit and talk about your book, Morningside, The 1979 Massacre and the Struggle for an American City Soul. Why'd you write this book in this part of history? Why is this important to you?
So in 2015, so you mentioned that I worked with my father for a long time now. And he's a painter. And so the Americans Who Tell the Truth Project is a series of paintings that he's made over the last 20 plus years of people who have stood up and spoken truth to power in our culture. In fact, there have been a few shows in New York, including one at St. John the Divine at one point, probably. He had a show at the Greensboro Civil Rights Center and Museum, the International Civil Rights Center and Museum in Greensboro, North Carolina, that is in the Woolworths where the sit-in movement started.
Mm-hmm.
And the woman who organized that show said, you know, and I went with him and my wife did too. So there were the three of us were there. And the woman who organized the show said, while you're here, there are these two people you have to meet. And so we went and sat down in this little Salvadoran cafe on the edge of downtown Greensboro called Manny's Universal Cafe. Mm-hmm. And we waited and thought, maybe they're not showing up. And then all of a sudden, the door opened and Nelson Johnson, Reverend Nelson Johnson now, and his wife Joyce Johnson came through. And we sat down with them and they talked with us for 2 hours and they told us their story.
Mm.
And it was, you know, I described that moment in Cuba when the hair stood up on the back of my neck. It happened again, Jules.
Wow.
And it's sort of like, this is when I know, I guess I need to go deeper, you know? And I thought, first of all, how the heck do I not know this history? This is an important moment in American history, and I had no idea. So part of it was just like this confusion about, you know, why hadn't I been told this? I need to go find out. But then there was another piece, and this is really, you know, what kept me going for 7 years to do this project, was I found them, their courage and their relentless struggle over more than five decades now, almost six, so inspiring. I mean, I just thought, these people are amazing. I want to spend more time with them. And mm-hmm. So, you know, a couple years later, when I could think about this project, I drove down to Greensboro and I sat with them and I said, would you trust me to spend more time with you and try to tell this story? And they said, yes. I mean, to be honest, they honored me with that, yes. Mm-hmm. And so I got to spend time, learn about them and their lives and this history and try to put it together, this big puzzle for me so I could understand it.
So much to take in from your response, friend. I mean, I'm looking at the art therapy that dad is able to lay out. You know, many times when I'm working with children and there's a struggle to put voice as to what the problem is, you ask them, here's a piece of paper, draw out what you think you saw, draw out what you think you're feeling right now. And it's amazing how people can put voice to paper by the use of a pen. And you guys have been doubly blessed with it, because you as a writer and an investigative writer, if you will, and dad using his skill set, really honored to hear this story. There's a piece of cultural competence that our schools are lacking. Some of this is where history books are just leaving some of the real important information that's out. And I can see how this can be an outlier, because it could bring difficulty to a lot of the stories that we really can't dive into because of the tension that they may stir up. But at the same time, I also feel that there has to be a place that this has to be written or talked about. And you have done that. And this is something that people who are listening to our show today and who will get it from my website, please go up there and find this book. There's important information, and you're going to hear about some heroes that we seldomly even know about. Regular names like, you know, Nelson Johnson and things like that, that are people that have changed and shaped the world that we are living in today based on things. What were some of the challenges for you as you were writing this book, though? What were some areas for you that you were like, man, am I getting this right? Should I go back? What were some of the struggles?
I'll tell you what, I love archives and I love going through old documents because I always find something surprising and interesting. But boy, the archive at the University of North Carolina around this is so darn big. I went in there and I thought, I could spend the rest of my life in here. How the heck am I going to figure out what to look at in order to tell this story? Because we're talking hundreds of thousands of pages of documents, because there were three trials and there were, you know, all this investigative work. And I mean, the truth is, at the time, this is one of the three largest FBI investigations in FBI Bureau history. Yeah. You know, there was, and so the amount of just paper to go through. So I really had to spend a lot of time talking with people, figuring out who my characters were going to be, who I could get access to, in order to shape the narrative enough so that I can make sense of the archives. So that was a real challenge, right? And it took time. Another challenge was passions run so high on all sides of this, you know? And while I came in through Nelson and Joyce Johnson, Reverend Johnson and his wife Joyce, when I sit for an interview, I try to be as open as possible to the point of view of the person who's talking. You know, I want to hear their story. I want to represent their story and let the reader decide. And figuring out, as I listened openly to policemen, FBI officers, politicians, you know, citizens around Greensboro, as well as the activists, I had to really work hard to find my own path through the different narratives and versions of this history that I was hearing until I could trust myself with their information, if you will. But one of the things that really helped me in that too, though, was the philosophy of the Johnsons. And they believe in that the humanity of every single person is sacred and in the possible transformation of every single person. This is their what they hold on to. And so when I went to write the book, I tried to do that too. You know, I didn't want to write a one-dimensional police officer. I wanted to tell you who this police officer really was and maybe how he made his decisions. And so I try to go deep into each character. And I'll tell you one more challenge while we're talking about the police was the police wall of silence, the blue wall of silence in Greensboro is real. You know, I had a very hard time getting police officers from that time to go on the record in a direct way with me about maybe what had happened. But they gave me insights into the culture of the department at that time that helped me understand the context in which this happened. So I'll give you a somewhat chilling example of that. I was in a cop bar in Greensboro and was brought there by a man who, a former police officer who ended up becoming a friend and really helping me with this, and very willing to be open in a way that a lot of people wouldn't in this situation. And he brought me to that cop bar. So I got access to the people there because I came with him.
Mm.
And so I was talking to this one officer who had been on duty that day, and it actually was the first officer on the scene after the shooting. And he started bragging to me about what a good officer he'd been in Greensboro. And he said, you know, I had a real knack for this. I can look at the way a black man walked, and I can tell you he was a good black man or a bad black man just by the way he walked. And if he was a bad one, I just followed him until he did something wrong and I picked him up. He said, I had a better arrest record than anyone else. And my jaw hit the floor in this cop car, you can imagine. I couldn't believe what, this was 2018, what I was hearing him brag about. And as I walked out, the guy who brought me in there said, don't be too hard on him. Well, you know, it gave me real insight into how that, you know, what the Johnsons were up against, what Greensboro was up against, what Black Greensboro was up against, you know, at that time.
So much detail, Aaron. And once again, you being able to swim under the amount of biases that even came up for you, because it sounds like every interview, every person you got closer to, you wanted to tell their truths in the best way possible. You had to become a version of them and try to look at that perspective. So you being swayed daily to stay on task, to stay on point, seems like a very difficult thing to do. So kudos to you to stay true to your craft and also letting the audience get into a real story. What are some things that are in your book that you feel are points or versions that people who were even in the part of history may or may not have known? And they say, wow, I didn't see that part. Can you tell us?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. So there's actually some parts of this book that I feel like are new revelations to history that have not been told before. And here's one of them that is very meaningful to me, because I feel like I stumbled and worked my way and interviewed my way into something significant. So there's an important moment in American history, which is the term of and report produced by something called the Church Committee, right? Mm-hmm. Which is the Church Committee in the mid-70s, aware of illegal activity in the CIA and FBI, decided to investigate. J. Edgar Hoover, the long-term director of the FBI, had died in 1972. This is a couple years later. He doesn't have the iron fist control over the Bureau anymore. And they begin to investigate what the FBI has done and how it's done it. And these stories about, you know, how they use counterintelligence techniques on American citizens to stop movements in this country was startling to people. And it's also at that time that it's revealed the degree to which they were interfering with the life and work of Martin Luther King Jr.
Mm.
So, 1976, they release their report. It comes out. It's based on some 20,000 FBI documents or so. And people are like, wow, all of a sudden, we have this trove of material to dig through going back. But the FBI is still an institution and operating, right?
Mm-hmm.
And no one's really looked at what they did between 1976 and the early 80s. After this, they all look back from this moment in these documents. And the FBI is going through a huge crisis. Like, who are we? You know, have we done the right thing or the wrong thing? You know, how do we put ourselves back together? Tons of agents are quitting. They saw in the Greensboro case a way to begin to resurrect their image by doing a big investigation and by doing it well. But what they didn't say was how much they'd known about what was going to happen before it happened.
From the get-go.
from the get-go. And so it becomes this very complicated moment where the FBI, so here's here to answer your question specifically. So a lot of the victims of the shooting thought, well, the FBI is out to get us. Well, you know, it's not like the FBI liked the Communist Workers Party and had no problem interfering with, you know, the lives and work of the Communist Workers Party, but they had a much bigger goal in mind, which was, you know, cleaning up the image of the FBI in the mind of the American people. Hmm. And they were going to use this event to do that, and they managed to do it. And because what they did is they said, well, if we'd had informants, you told us after the church committee that we couldn't have informants anymore the same way. Said, if we'd had informants, we wouldn't have let this happen. Well, technically that was true, but they also did know what was going to happen and didn't do anything about it.
It's a damn shame. Sometimes you listen to some of these organizations, whether it is a big unit like the FBI, hospitals and other departments, this code that lives within the boundaries that are not stepped over. It's amazing when you join some sort of team that you must abide by these certainties and uncertainties, if you will. You have to like rest upon the beliefs and values that are already etched. There's something you can't cross. You know, I had some interviews in the past with some great doctors who are in the middle of such things like we're talking about. They are still noticing that in the emergency rooms, we are having a high number of minorities who are still shot, who are still looked at as learning guinea pigs because they are the only ones who come in from homicides and assaults. So doctors are able to learn. And when doctors go oppose and say, hey, maybe we should bring more awareness, why the hell do we want to do that? That's going to stop us from practicing and getting better at our craft. So the numbers is what really count. So everywhere you look, there is a piece of unity that goes either for the right or for the wrong. And here I am listening to some of that still in your voice. How do you feel racism is going in our country? Some positives are, what are things that we're doing that are going in the right direction? Or what do we need to do more of to kind of stop this?
Well, let me get to that. And I think that what I'm going to say, I thought what you were saying was so smart and perceptive, because every single group in my book has its limitations, whether it's the police or the FBI or the communists, the activists, right? They all have their group, and there's a certain cohesiveness that they need to have within that group, a sort of tribal mentality, if you will, that creates blind spots, you know? And things that they don't do that they should have done, or mistakes that they make because this is the way we do things. And that's true. And I think, you know, that's not just true of law enforcement. That's true of every group and every group in my book to some degree. Let me get at your question in this way. You know, I've noticed that Donald Trump is calling Kamala Harris Comrade Kamala. Trying to paint her as a communist. And I believe that has nothing to do with her relationship to capitalism or the American, you know, economic system, but it's a subtle tie to racial wink, right? To say, you know, she's going to help out these people more than you, and therefore, you know, and try to level the playing field, and there are going to be winners and losers, and you're going to lose, right? And I think it's this old, you know, the red baiting and the name calling of communism has been used to undermine, you know, movements of minorities and marginalized people in this country for, you know, 100 years or more. I don't think it's going to have much effect. I have a hard time beyond a certain his face, right, that will believe anything. It seems archaic a little bit at this point to me. I'll be surprised if that has an impact. And I think part of the reason it won't is because I think we have moved the line on who is America and who isn't.
Mm.
And I think that there is a more, perhaps, maybe I live in a bubble, but a more, that it's harder to circumscribe some people out of that based on the color of their skin. I think that that just, I don't think it works the same way it used to work. Not that there aren't plenty of triggers and plenty of mistakes and plenty of inequalities that still exist. That's, I'm not saying that, but I don't think people want to subscribe to that the same way that they did so easily before. I don't know. What do you think? Do you think?
Well, there's a lot to be said on both sides of the field here, right? Because like every dilemma or debate, you have things that are coming at from both angles. For me, at least growing up in an urban setting, I can tell you that there is so much that still needs to be done. I feel that growing up in Harlem and Washington Heights, I've seen enough to know enough that if you look a certain color, if you walk a certain way, if I wear a hoodie versus wearing a suit, I may or may not be perceived. So some of the stories that you talked about are still prevalent because there's a lot of ways that people have stayed and remained, but there are others who are now woke and now have changed their way of thinking for a better view or a more holistic view because now they have children, because now they're vested, because now they're married into interracial kind of marriages and things have crossed the line, if you will. And there's a sense of respect that comes with that. I still say there's an uphill battle, but I think that it's players like you and me and others who believe in what's right and not really what's correct, because there's a lot of times that we cross that line and really stay true to what we believe in. And we don't stay thinking about what the organization may feel or what these peoples may lead us to. We stay true to what we believe. And I think that more of that is what's needed, but that's not enough of it, if you will. I still say that for a writer like yourself, that you have the space to create the open view, I think that that is the best channel for us to make our decisions on our own. And I think you did a fantastic job with this book and letting people in on all views. You didn't lean one way, you didn't think another. You just said, this is what I saw happen, and you brought that to life. Is there a story for you that really says to you every day, I'm going to get up, or maybe like you say, makes those hairs stand up for me? Is there a story, a movement, if you will, that has pulled you that sometimes you're really down and out and you think about this person, you think about this case and say, I got to bring it today? Is there such a story?
There's a man, maybe you've heard of him, called Reverend Lennox Yearwood, who's of the Hip Hop Caucus.
Mm-hmm.
And his activating moment was, he's from Louisiana, was Katrina, and who died in Katrina. And he has become this dynamic and compelling climate activist, bringing the fight for against climate change into communities of color and to marginalized people. But his goal is to break down these silos, you know, between people of cause, right? So it's, you've got feminists over here and LGBTQ over here and, you know, black and brown, or black over here and brown over there, right?
Mm-hmm.
And his goal is to find the common causes that can bring people together from all of these different walks of cause, right? And toward justice, and get them working together. And I find that very inspiring, because I think that, you know, in the same way that the activists that I wrote about were trying to bring white and black together, mill workers, the poor white and the poor black, something that is, you know, powerful people have been preventing from happening in the South since Reconstruction, you know, after the Civil War. Seeing him do that in a more spherical way, like because of America's diversity, I find truly inspiring.
Mm. I was thinking about something closer to home, and I didn't want to bring her up, but wife is an incredible writer too. And you and you guys probably going off and bouncing ideas. I'm saying to myself, is there a way that as you're putting this masterpiece together that she's there and she's like, do you have any questions? Do you think I can help? Were there moments for you that you said, yes, I feel like opening up and sharing, but giving her her space as well? Is there moments like for you in such a great household where two great writers live? How do you deal with this?
Great question. 100%. My goodness. I couldn't have written this book without Margot's guidance. You know, and to be honest with you, the gift that Hidden Figures gave both of us, which was time to write our next books. You know, I'm still amazed at the resonance that Hidden Figures have. You know, just this past Wednesday, she was up in Washington, D.C., and the women in her book were being awarded the Congressional Gold Medal of Honor. I mean, it's just remarkable. So anyway, yeah, no, I have been blessed in a number of ways, but there is no good fortune like the good fortune I have of having married Margot Lee.
And, amazing stuff.
But I'll tell you something really important about that is not only did I get to bounce ideas off her, but at one point when I was researching this, her parents said, we want to go down to Greensboro with you and meet these people that you're writing about.
Mm.
And so her parents, who are the same generation of Reverend Johnson and his wife, came down and they shared with me their perspective on this Greensboro struggle and what their lives have been like growing up in Virginia. And it added a whole level of nuance and depth to what that I never would have been able to get to on my own. And without that sort of family touch, you know? And it was so generous of them to do that.
Mm. Aaron, thank you so much for letting us in, even on the personal side and family. It says a lot about the man that you are, and you don't have nothing but greatness coming from you as well. I know you're giving your wife props, but your story is also a great one that has touched history and decades and will be told for years to come. My friend, the floor is yours. Take us away. What do you want us to remember about you, the movement, next steps, and what's coming up for you and in your great journey?
Well, I think you'll be interested in this. I'm still, in a way, digesting what this book means to me. So I look forward to being out on the road. It's going to be launched on October 15th. If anyone listening is any, go to my website, aaronshetterly.com. Look where my events are. Please come. Please share your thoughts, because whenever people read something I've written and share their thoughts, I learn something. I'm really getting excited about this journey where all of a sudden this book isn't mine anymore. It's ours. And it's going to be a give and take. So that's something that's coming up. And I'll tell you one thing that you'll be interested in, Jules. It's my next book. I'm going back to Latin America. So we'll be talking Spanish the next time we talk.
Listen, we're going to bring you on and have another show, El Latino y su Labor. I'd love to get you on, but that'll be another show altogether. And I do want to continue to learn with you, dear friend, because today you taught me about how to learn something. I learned that the strongest survive because they remain weak in the heat of the battle. Resilience is when you find strength and courage to smile as you push through these challenges. Your smile, that is where the true power is found, because victory favors the fearless. All this platform, it was built because way too often as people, we were overlooked or labeled. But this is no longer. Our plight and our fight is for anyone and everyone who feels a need to be understood. We are strong as individuals, but unstoppable when we unite. Tune in, friends, to another He's Just a Social Worker show coming to another town near you real soon. We're out. Thank you so much, Aaron.
Thank you.
Please note that the views expressed here are my own and not a representation of my employers and clients. Thank you for listening. We're always here for you. Just message us and we'll get back to you within 24 hours. Thank you. More than just at He's Just a Social Worker. In memory of my mother, Matilde De La Rosa, this is dedicated to you, Mom. Miss you so much. En memoria de mi madre, Matilde De La Rosa, esto va dedicado a ti, Mamá. Te extraño mucho.